the asset no, any longer, that means the construction company or the sellers should recognize revenue. In that sense, I think judgment in seller's perspective is either logically and conceptually allowable as a secondary indicator. I understand that the ED focuses on bias perspective in assessment of whether the control transfer or not. But in that case, if it's not clear to assess whether the control is transfer, in that case, as a secondary indicator, the seller's perspective should be allowed. Yeah, I think so.
Thank you very much. So I think that regarding this transfer notions, I think that what we are talking about is a seller's accounting, but the, in terms of the transfer of the controls, and we just focus on the customers, say, rights, or customer, whether a customer can do or something. So that is this kind of, say, definition of transfer is, I understand what you have pointed out. We are based on the IS-39 type of the transfer notion, I think. So we focus on the customer and the reflection of, the, if customer has the sort of the freedom of to dispose or to do something with the asset. So I think that the sellers already lost their control. So that is a notion, I think. Oh, Henry.
I just wanted to add that that notion that in certain cases we ought to look at the seller's perspective for the control was something that, that came up last week at the round table in Norwalk as well, and it's definitely sort of something that we thought that we should look at, that in certain difficult cases which these construction contracts often pose, that it could be helpful to think about has the transfer taken place from the seller's perspective as well. So it's definitely something that we will be considering.
Yes, please. Oh, please.
I am deputy manager of accounting, responsible for the housing and development sector at Samsung CNT. I have a concern on the first indicator, customer specific. We are already using customer specific as an indicator of a transfer of control. For this thing, it is too narrowly defined. Why? Because it is the definition of customer-specific design concerns only two factors, design and function, and that design and function are not always a good indicator for transfer of control. For example, in Korea, there are two types of apartment construction contracts. One is the construction projects initiated by housing co-ops. The other one is the construction project initiated by private construction companies. The economic substance of these two types of projects is exactly the same, except for the customer's ability in specifying the design or function of the property to build. What I mean is that housing co-ops can specify the design and function of the property before it is built. However, when an apartment complex project is initiated by a construction company, customers could not specify its major structural design because they are unidentifiable at the designing stage. Besides this fact, all other economic substances are the same. Nonetheless, if the first indicator is applied as it is currently defined, they would end up with using different revenue recognition methods. You are not sure whether design and function is such an important fact that make us apply different accounting rules. For these two substantially identical construction projects, therefore, we suggest that the customer-specific should include more factors that could properly represent the characteristics of the real estate construction industry. One of the facts would be location, which includes the element of property such as price, view, flow, transportation, and exclusion. We suggest location because location has much greater impact on the value of a property than the design and function in many cases. Thank you.
So one question. Location is, say, could you explain about the location? Why it's so important?
Location actually means could mean many things. What I think what he says is that, you know, the value of the property is not just depending upon the design or function. Instead, the location can determine, I mean, has determines more value of the property. So, for example, school zone can make a big difference in the prices, and also the view of the apartment. For example, think about the apartments in Manhattan. If the apartment can have a view of the Central Park, it's going to have a high value. If it doesn't, it's going to have a very low value. So location view has a very important thing in real estate industry. So that, for example, you know, the apartment, any unit in the apartment cannot be replaced with the other units at all. That means that the customer specifies that apartment for his own needs. So that...
Okay, so I understand. So you're expanding the fourth criteria to some extent. Okay, thank you. So
I was just going to add that the challenge, though, and I understand your point. I guess the challenge is that with any real estate contract, you've got that sort of very specific nature in it, including, say, a typical UK contract where you make a deposit up front, and then you don't make any progress payments, and you just pay the balance of the consideration at contract completion. Essentially, so long as the customer doesn't breach that contract, essentially the constructor is going to have to ultimately deliver that specific property to that customer. And I'm not sure everybody would think in that situation that the revenue recognition should be the same as over here.
Okay, so Tadashi. Oh, so he raised up hand first.
Based on the observation of the current discussion, I have some suggestion to the ISB and FSB. And first of all is the fourth indicators in paragraph 30D is the design and specification. I think that I understand that it is one of the just indicator, not the criteria to determine whether continuous transfer of control. It's just one of the indicator, but the inclusion of this indicator that could be serious concern about particular industry in particular jurisdictions. And my understanding that design specification itself does not represent the who controls the asset itself. It's rather that if the design is so specific, the usually that seller requires the buyer to protect their seller's to cover the secure their rights, because they cannot sell to the other customers. So they can usually require that, like unconditional payment, the progress payment, or upfront payment. So the specification itself is not the criteria. It's a larger indicators. If there is a specification, usually the normal business says that the indicator or the others, so the preparer should look at the other indicator carefully, such as unconditional payment. This is my first suggestion. The second one is the exposure draft is written based on the control and on the customer's perspective rather than entity's perspective, is because the customer obtained the control or not. But sometimes the control of the asset by the customer is quite unclear in that some real estate industry or construction industry. At that time, I suggest that look at the customers' continuous increase in the obligations, because that obligation is continuously considered, obligation is considered increase. That means in the indicates that customers' controls of the asset is continuously increase. The sub suggestion is this is a customer's perspective, but the both only focus on the customer in the business. In other words, it's only to take it the B2B situations, because the paragraph 27 particularly says you focus on the cash flow, future cash flow, because the customer is a business, it's correctly grasps the situation, but the customer may be a consumer or maybe the government. The B2C or B2Z situation, that its benefit, future benefit embodied in the asset could not be a future cash flow for the customer or like a consumer or government. So that's more like the paragraph should be contains that in the case of the consumer or the government in the directly benefit notion that rather than future cash flow notion that.
Just a short chance, please. Yeah.
Thanks, Tatsumi. I'd just like to understand how does risk and rewards fit into the control model in the ED? Is that one of the indicators?
Henry?
We haven't specifically had risk and rewards as an indicator, but... but I know that there are many commentators have said or suggested that you can't divorce control and risk and rewards, and I think that's correct. And therefore, you know, clearly having risk and benefit, risk and rewards can often be a clear indication that you've got control. So that's something that we will think about, whether we should factor that into however we end up articulating the transfer notion.
Have you finished, or you would like to continue?
I've got a comment to make. I think in the consolidation project, the tentative decisions made by the board is that risk and rewards, it's basically...
Oh, I'm sorry.
What happened? Oh, no,
risk and rewards, it's basically an indicator of control. It's an important element of control. And, you know, if we are introducing control in the revenue recognition standard, and if that it's not been incorporated, I think this is it's going to introduce inconsistency across the standards. Thanks.
So now, Catherine, please.
I was just going back to the point about the contracts having a buyer protection element, and the point that you made about the UK. I think the contrast is how you're protecting the buyer. So if you're buying property in the UK, your protection as a buyer is that until the thing is finished, if it doesn't carry on, you'll get your money back. The protection I think that we're talking about in this region is that the government ensures that if you want to buy a house and you've put down the progress payments and you've helped the developer, at the end of the day, you will get that house. It may be a bit delayed, or the apartment, whatever. And that is a fundamental difference. So looking at the buyer protection, the slant on the buyer protection, I think, is very important as to what the buyer could end up with.
So, Prasada?
I just had a clarification question with Tadashimi. Are you suggesting that the scope of the model is not clear in terms of, like, when I receive government grants or in a transaction where in a public sector it's not a sale of goods or services, but it's rather like an education services? Is that your clarification you're looking for? I was not clear in terms of what you're trying to highlight.
Which one? My previous comments on the which suggestion? The first one?
You mentioned about that the standard is like you might be the business to.
In the particularly look at the paragraph 27, and you mentioned that the paragraph 27 that is a customer's control of the assets or services described based on the future cash flows. But it's only the customer is a business organization. The customer may be a consumer because when I buy a TV, I do not expect any future cash flow because I just enjoy watching the TV. And in the case of the government is a purchaser, they cannot create any future cash flow. So your more general description of the customer's benefit, not focus on the future cash flow rather than it's only the customer is a business.
I want to clarify specifically in the U.S. FASB's document, there's a lot of consequential amendments in the back. And in the U.S., there's a specific gap on not-for-profit entities and public sector entities. And we specifically excluded, scoped out in exchange and grants.
I'm not talking about any grants. That's a commercial transaction. But the customer, you are talking about establishing the standards for private sector business entity. But you write this document based on the customer's perspective, not the entity perspective. So your entities, preparers should be a private sector business entities, but customer may or may not be a business. Customer may be a general consumer, individual. The customer may be a not-for-profit organization. It's not a grant situation. That's a commercial transaction, but the customer could be a government, could be a consumer, could be a not-for-profit organization. I would like to say that.
So we have three people in the queue. So Bilen and Millie and Dr. Yao.
Thank you, Dasumi. I think one suggestion, perhaps the document to make clear that what you're talking about is effective control. So to eliminate this misperception that it must be a physical control. I think the other point is more on a general point regarding risks and rewards. If you look at the ED on consolidation, control is really the main principle. I guess risk and rewards is something like subsume or maybe one of the indicators within that control notion. And when you come to this revenue standard, I think like Henry pointed out, I think the whole document, you can't really see the mention about risk and rewards. It's really bang on control. So it gave us the indication that, look, now going forward, you know, really the thing is control, control, control. But if you look at the leases exposure draft, you know, you have, especially the part from the lessor accounting, you really look at risks and rewards. You know, whether the lessor transfer the risks and rewards, then you determine whether you use the recognition or performance obligation approach. So my comment is, I think, maybe the ISB would like to make clear whether really now risks and rewards is really on the table, because it seems to get different perception that really whether now risks and rewards is within the indicators.
Yeah, so thank you. But just so I respond to you that the risk and reward is currently in IS 18, but in most cases we could use the risk and reward under this control model, but say the control model discard the risk and reward. That is my understanding of this proposal, because if the seller retains the sort of the risk and reward to some extent, so under 18, the recognition of the revenue will be delayed. So, and we would like to avoid that situation. In most cases, as notion of risk and reward and the control can go together, but in extreme cases, I think that our notion of control is so different from the risk and reward. And my personal view is I don't like the analogy to the lesser accounting. So I should not be emotional, but anyway. So Millie, please.
Thanks. I think we were talking about the indicator of unconditional obligation to pay. I think what is not clear is whether that's in respect of the different milestones, or is that saying that this must, because in Malaysia, the milestone payments, once
they are met, it must be paid. So there is unconditional obligation to pay, but that's also under the overall umbrella of the contract, whereby that the whole contract must be fulfilled and must be met, or otherwise kind of underwritten by a financier bank on behalf of the buyer. So I think the what is not clear is whether if you've met the, you know, you've made the 30% milestone payment, and then you have ability therefore to sell your interest in the contract at that point, does that mean that control has transferred to the buyer, albeit it's over, you know, there's an overall arching umbrella that that the, you know, all the payments must be made, because in order for the buyer to be able to transfer the interest in the contract at those milestone payments. And I think in Malaysia, that the, because the financier bank is there, if anything happens, then the financier bank steps in the role of the customer, but the financier bank is not, it didn't start out with being the customer in the first place. So how does that fit into the revenue model?
Just I would like to clarify, I do not understand. Say that the banks provide the finance to the customer, so, and then banks get into, say, they will get the control of the
The customer makes the milestone payments, but the bank of that finances the customer underwrites the whole transaction. So how does that feature in the ED? Because it's a tripartite agreement, so to say. So the bank that finances the customer, it's not the customer who's actually buying the particular unit, but because he is there, there is some sort of guarantee that the customer will transfer of the unit will pass over to either the customer, or if not, then the bank will step in.
All right. So that means.
So how does that fit in?
Sorry. It is not a tripartite agreement. What happens is, you know, the reason why we say, because we were arguing about risks and rewards previously, and in the previous position, it is the buyer that actually finances the construction. And the buyer can, of course, choose to either do it by way of cash or by taking a bank loan. If the buyer takes a bank loan, the loan is in the buyer's name. So that's why, you know, in order for the buyer to be able to give good security to the bank, naturally the developer is no longer permitted to be able to use or pledge or charge the asset. So this new definition of control actually, just in paragraphs 26 and 27, make a lot of sense to us. But you know, I think where... does that help clarify a bit? Yeah? So it's not that it is so much a tripartite, but I suppose I think someone else... the degree to which the buyer has in a way committed to the transaction, because ultimately what we are trying to see is whether the transaction is cancelable or not, and that comes back to what Catherine was saying. The nature of the buyer protection is very important. Are you trying to say that if the developer does not perform, the buyer is able to walk at the end of the day? Or in the case of Malaysia, there has been concern about abandoned housing projects. It actually effectively shows that the buyer cannot walk. Yes, we would say that, you know, from a buyer protection standpoint, it is not great. The reason why we don't have insurances in the way that maybe Korea has is because the government is trying to keep the price of houses low. The more factors you put in, you know, to try to introduce all these build and sell models, then it becomes very, very expensive. And, you know, you could end up in a situation like in Hong Kong where you only have three big players and no one else can come in. And then the prices just become stratospheric because banks will not finance something that they don't have good security over. In Malaysia, it is actually very spread out. The model that we have actually works perfectly with good regulation, because the instant the buyer signs the agreement with the developer, they have all the rights, underlying rights over the property to enable them to be able to finance it, give good security, and at the end of the day, they will get the property. Should the developer fail, they are actually stuck with the risk of the uncompleted property. So, you know, that is the real situation that we have here. And I think it varies, but probably Catherine's guide is a good guide to have. What kind of protection are we looking at? Because ultimately, you're worried about cancelability.
Okay, so, thank you. So, Dr. Yao, please.
Thank you. I want to touch on two conceptual issues here. I'm struggling with the issues about the gentleman was just raised. Are we reporting the customer's satisfaction in the preparer's financial statement, or are we actually reporting the entity's activities? I read your BC of this exposure draft that the reason the ISB rejected the activity-based model, that one of which is that it would be counterintuitive to many users to recognize revenue when the customer have not received any goods or service. And most importantly, what I think, they say that there would be potential for abuse if you use the activity-based. I was wondering whether ISB can provide some example or some evidence as to the fact that the contractual model or the contract model adopted by the ED can eliminate this abuse to any extent. And the problem, the conceptual problem we have been facing is that are we reporting the activities of the customers or our activities as a reporting entity? Secondly, what is the meaning of the top line revenue? Are we recognizing something that is totally completed and controlled past as per the restrictive definition given? Or are we actually telling the shareholders of the company that this is the progress, these are the activities have been undertaken by our company? So where are we? And also I share some concern about the risk and reward that has been so-called inconsistently applied. And on one hand, you say you're not going to use it, whether as an indicator or not. I think, like Billing was just raised just now, I think it is ultimately crucial to ISB to really to indicate to all the to the users of your financial statements is that the users of your accounting standard, that from which perspective are you taking, for example, contract-based that you are not, that you are espousing at the moment, which I don't think the reasons given by ISB are convincing enough for us to come up with a new so-called revenue recognition principle altogether. Because I think the reason for preventing abuse, I do not think that is the primary consideration for setting an accounting standard. Because I could turn around to say that, are you guaranteeing me that by complying with your accounting standard, that no abuse would occur?
Thank you for your extreme criticism on this issue. So I think that the reporting, say, top line is try to report the sellers or reporting entities' activities. In order to do so, just we use the customers, whether control has been transferred to customer or not. So it's just a tool. So no intention has not been changed. And regarding the activity-based or contract-based, if I'm wrong, so Henry can correct it, but activity-based is just entity make up the goods based on that activities. We should recognize revenue. I don't think it's the right way to go. So that is the reason why we refuse that. So I'm a little bit confused just about time, but still, this is a contentious issue, and okay, please.
I'm not going to make it long. I'm going to make it short. I just add one thing onto the activity-based accounting. You know, I think we have to think about the needs of the information users. Many information users want the activity-based accounting. For example, management want it, the tax authority want it, and also insurance companies want the activity-based accounting. They want to know how much the construction has been done. So that we shouldn't just ignore activity-based accounting, even though it has lots of problems. So that's what the one point I want to make. And the other one the other point I want to say is that I just want to classify what customer-specific means and why we say location was important. When I read the customer-specific, the indicator, what I think is that the ED just think the possibility whether the seller can sell the product to different customers when the customer cancels the contract. But there could be another case, whether the seller can replace the product with another product for the same customer. So that's what we meant by the apartment, apartment unit 401, for example. If the seller doesn't want to give that apartment to that specific customer, is it possible that the seller can give another apartment like 802 to the same customer? The customer will not accept that because, as I said, the view is different, location is different, and many things are different in real estate industries. So now I want to think about the customer what you really meant by the customer specific. That's what I want to say.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Paul.
In some jurisdictions, one form of buyer protection is the option that Prasad referred to earlier. That is, if the buyer wants, they just walk. We, in the last few years, have experienced in most parts of the world an upmarket. But I remember driving from the KL airport to downtown in the late 1990s, and there were just ghost buildings, the whole highway. Everybody who's a Malaysian will remember that. And the customers just walked away. So the issue that we have as the standard setter is what have we transferred to the customer halfway through construction if they can walk without having paid? Now, that may not be the case here, but it is the case in some parts of the world where, other than forfeiting a down payment, you don't lose a lot as a customer. You can walk in a down market.
Paul, can I correct that? The customer cannot walk. That is precisely the problem that we have here with abandoned housing. They continue to be liable for the loans because the loans were taken in their own name, and the banks will come after them for the interest.
The banks will go after.
Yes, yes. They cannot walk.
Okay, so I'm really conscious about the time. So, and the last person will be Swat Chan. Okay.
I just want. To add to what the Korean delegates has mentioned in terms of the specific design, I think what we are referring to here is really the fact that the asset is actually a unique non-fungible asset. So once the entity has committed to sell, say, level 5 of the building unit number 01, for example, the seller can't basically substitute it with another unit in the same apartment, same location. So what we are really looking at is a non-fungible asset. And the other thing is, if the customer is given an option to select from a list of standardized options, and the customer has made that selection at the onset of the contract, then surely that must mean something. Surely the entity will not be able to, change the option, turn it around, manufacture it and kind of like substitute it with another option. So wouldn't that also be something that the board should consider in writing the standard? Thanks.
So thank you very much. So I think that under this control notion, the real estate transaction is so controversial and it's so different in the various types is existed in country by country. So, and but obviously we cannot deal with each individual country's cases. So I expect staff will come back with a bright idea. So I think that we would like to have a break, and I would like to reduce the time, and we should come back by 25. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, no, no. Say 11:25. 30.
Just,
oh, really?
No, those clocks are fast.
Yeah, this clock is wrong, I think.
Yeah, that's fast.
Sir?
It's quarter past.
Yeah.